Hi, this is Sedge Thompson. Welcome to this special audio highlights podcast from West Coast Live. For more information about our shows and other guests and podcasts, wcl.org. My next guest on West Coast Live is the director of the Royal Academy. His title there is Secretary and Chief Executive. His previous professional career included director of the National Portrait Gallery and the National Gallery in London. Those of you who remember Brideshead Revisited and Castle Howard will know that he has written a book about the architecture of the building, the sociology of the people who live there, and the designers of the house. And it's appropriate that his new book talks about the academy he now runs, the Royal Academy in London, there off of Piccadilly. It's called The Company of Artists, The Origins of the Royal Academy of Arts in London. Please welcome Charles Summerez Smith.
Very good. Well, I look forward to it.
So the Royal Academy is something that George III, much maligned monarch in the United States because he was the monarch during the American Revolution, was behind the establishment of this Royal Academy. But before this, I was interested, you told the history of clubs and societies of artists. What was London in those days when artists would get together?
Well, what you get the sense of is a lot of the artists lived in Soho and Covent Garden. It's quite a close community. In fact, one of the things I really like about the book, which I wasn't really responsible for, is the map in the end papers, where I had asked and encouraged the designer to do a map, and he took an incredible amount of trouble plotting exactly where everything happened. I mean, I'd done a list. But what you realise is that it's all within walking distance, which is sort of obvious, but you realise the first meeting was at St. James's Palace, and then the place where they exhibited is just down the road on Pall Mall, and then Reynolds is living on the west side of Leicester Fields, and then up the road is this pub in Soho, which they all met in the Turkshead Tavern in Gerrard Street. And over the road from the Turkshead Tavern is the house that Edmund Burke lived. And then they all go and have supper in the house up in Great Portland Street, which Joseph Wilton had built, which is the posher neighbourhood. And you get the feel of a very, very close community. And as in close communities, you also get friction and factions. And I think I hadn't realised, it's unusual as a book that I didn't really plan to write it. I mean, Castle Howard, I spent as long writing it as it took to build it, whereas this book, I just started one day trying to work out in my own mind how it came about, and I put down the 28th November 1768 and worked out what happened then, and then I found to my surprise I actually knew what happened on the 29th of November 1768 and what happened on the 1st of December, the 4th of December, the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th up to the day it was founded. So that it was a book which evolved slightly organically. I didn't plan it. And in a way, I'm pleased with it precisely because I think having written it at speed is exactly what happened in 1768. They didn't plan to have a Royal Academy, but somehow at speed, because the previous Society of Artists had blown up with a great row, William Chambers walked out of a meeting in early November, went off to see the king. King said, I've always had this idea, and I think they had talked about it before. It comes out in less than 2 weeks.
Was that fast to have something established with a royal approval at that time?
I think it feels fast. I mean, the reason I wrote the book is that we still operate more or less by laws which were first agreed on the 10th of December 1768. And because I'm the so-called secretary of the Royal Academy, I'm the person who's expected to know about the laws. And actually, I don't really have that sort of mindset, which is legalistic. And a lot of the academicians are terribly interested in the laws. And one of them said to me, oh, you do know that Samuel Johnson wrote the laws. And I knew just enough about 18th century history to be a bit sceptical about this. And then another of them said, oh, you do know that the laws were the origins of the American Constitution. And I knew just enough about 18th century American history to be rather sceptical about that. But then I thought, well, how come that these laws, which were quite sophisticated and demonstrate quite a complex set of how to establish the constitution of a society, how did they come to be written, as they ostensibly were, in the space of 10 days? That's very fast. it was a combination of writing at speed in a pragmatic way. Somebody would have said, oh, do you think we should have a library? And somebody else would have said, yes, we should. And then Edward Penny probably said, let's make sure the library has some good things about trophies and arms. And probably the original secretary, who was called Francis Milner Newton, sat down and wrote a paragraph about the library. But some of it probably antedates the original writing of the laws by at least 20 years. Because there had been all these previous attempts to set up artist societies.
And why would there be an artist society? I mean, artists often work on their own. Yes, they would gather and eat and drink in the evening, but what was the function of an artist society? Was it to protect them as artists from, I don't know, commercial forces? What was the impetus to have this kind of an organization?
I think there were three things. One is a social function. I mean, when I launched the book, I said that I thought it was good to have a party because that had always been one of the purposes of the Royal Academy. And one of the artists shouted in the back, no, it was for art. but actually, in retrospect, I should have said read the book because it was for art, but it was also for a sense of creating a community of artists who often work in isolation so that they wanted to get together, partly to meet one another and talk and drink and socialise, but also for a sense of social status. I think there was a feeling that it had traditionally been a craft activity and they wanted to professionalise it so that it was, as with lots of, like the Royal Society and the Society of Antiquaries, it was creating something which had a social function in society at large. And then the second thing was that they wanted to have an exhibition. Previously, if you wanted to see contemporary art, you had to go off to a country house or, you know, the church didn't really commission art so that it wasn't visible. And all through the 1750s and 1760s, artist societies were set up in order to have annual exhibitions so that there was the Society of Artists and then there was another one called the Free Society of Artists, and then the Academy in a way trumped the two because it had slightly fewer artists who were better, so it had more social status and they could sell their stuff for more money. So it's what I call the exhibition function. And then the third one is teaching. If you look back at the previous artist societies, some of it is just so that they would meet in order to be able to practice their drawing, because drawing was at the heart of, it's the arts of design, as they called it. Whether you were making little gold boxes, or whether you were doing sculpture, or whether you were doing painting, you were expected to be able to draw well professionally, and in order to improve your drawing, it was better to meet once a week and have a model. You couldn't afford to have a model. And anyway, I suspect, I mean, I don't know about this, and it's not recorded, you don't necessarily want to have a naked model in the drawing room on your own, because it's somehow inhibiting and not quite proper. So you would have 30 people drawing a naked model, and then it became part of your professional practice.
Was there a difference whether the model was a man or a woman?
The male model goes back more to classical antiquity, and you were expected to do both. And in fact, in the original laws published in 1716 in December, didn't include all the issues about the hiring of the models. What they decided to do is work that out in the next few months. And so in March, they published bylaws, and that includes the female models were paid slightly more, I suppose, you know, you needed a slight premium. And it says how much they're paid. They're paid quite well. The male model tended to be the person who was, you know, guarding the door and was the sort of tough man in the establishment. And then I suppose, you know, come Thursday evening, he would strip off and they would all draw him.
The artists in the Royal Academy were painters. I mean, as you say, it was all about, was it the disegno, the design? You had to be able to draw before you were able to do the other work and move on to the narrative, the metaphorical imagery and so forth. These were mostly painters, but you also had architects. And there's something about the way painters and architects didn't always get along. The painters seemed to be more rambunctious, the architects perhaps more organized.
I think that's correct, that the key person is really not Joshua Reynolds, who's always thought of as the founding father, but William Chambers, because Chambers was very cosmopolitan. He'd been born in Sweden, he'd gone out to China, he was trained in Paris, then he spent a lot of time in Italy, he came back to London, and he was asked to teach the king to draw. so that he was professionally very well established. He'd published books on architecture. But the painters, you feel, were slightly suspicious of him. Somehow that Chambers was slightly too professionally competent and was slightly too closely connected to the king, that they didn't mind him being treasurer, looking after the money, but they didn't want him to be president. So poor old Edward Penny had the tricky task of telling Chambers at the critical moment that although he quite obviously wanted to be president, the painters weren't going to have him as president. And at that point, they decide that actually the obvious person is Reynolds, and somebody, probably Penny, is sent off to see Reynolds. And initially Reynolds said, no, I don't want to have anything to do with it. I'm going to stay loyal to the Society of Artists. And then Benjamin West, the American painter, is sent off and said, well, look, frankly, we've all decided that you're going to do it, and the king wants you to do it, and you don't have any option. And then at that point, Reynolds says, well, maybe I will, but I'm first of all going to go and talk to my friends Edmund Burke and Samuel Johnson and seek their advice. And the king never really forgives him. I think it's part of the reason the king felt Reynolds was somehow somebody to be slightly suspicious of. He didn't like his art, he didn't like him, he probably didn't like his politics. But in the end, Reynolds agrees.
We're talking with Charles Summers Smith. His current book is called The Company of Artists, The Origins of the Royal Academy of the Arts in London, and it's published by Bloomsbury Press. Nowadays, the role of art in a society, in a political conversation, seems much different, perhaps diminished, than it was in the 18th century, where it seemed to be part of the vitality of the culture. I can't imagine the Queen of England or the President of the United States getting involved in the establishment and the arguments, the disputatiousness over the establishment of an art school, an art society.
Well, funny enough, one of the things, I don't have that many regrets about the book, but one of the ones I slightly have is I think I underplay George III's role, because as I've thought about it subsequently, I suspect when they went to see him, he certainly, I'm pretty sure, was the person who said, look, if you're going to have a society, you've got to have a set of rules. He had that sort of constitutional mindset. And he was correct, because all the previous societies, artist societies, had dissolved. And I think his interest, and it was a real commitment and engagement. It wasn't just, I'm the authority figure in the distance in St. James's Palace or Buckingham House, which I think he was active. He was buying works by Benjamin West. Benjamin West is not now regarded as the greatest painter of the 18th century, but the king liked it because it was subject painting and history painting, and it had moral content. So that I think part of his aspiration in the establishment of the Royal Academy was to create a sense of public art which had moral content.
We're in East London at the moment having this conversation, and nearby, down the road, is the Whitechapel Gallery. In the 19th century, was used to hold public exhibitions of art with public and moral purpose, that there were lessons to be taught through art about the downfallen woman, the effect of drink, and so forth, and the idea that the public could come in and see these paintings to uplift their lives, to instruct them, seems to come out of that idea of the public and moral world of the art. How was the general public invited into the exhibitions of the Royal Academy, or was it just kind of the great and the good at the time who would come and see those?
No, I think what you're describing in many ways has its origins in Britain in the 1760s, because up until then, the great majority of professional practice in painting was portraiture, and portraiture is portraiture. I mean, Reynolds would have six sitters a day, and day after day, that was the way he made his money. But Benjamin West had spent time in Italy, and when he came to London, he wanted to paint grand subject pictures from antiquity to encourage people to know about antique narrative. And in a way, I think you have to think of it more as a version of a film, that it was a way of seeing scenery. It was an experience. And I mean, I'm not that keen on Benjamin West, but funny enough, I was at an event in Buckingham Palace, and I was standing around waiting for something to happen, and I was in a corridor, and suddenly there was the picture which Benjamin West had exhibited in the first annual exhibition of the Royal Academy. And actually, it's very impressive. It's huge, and it has narrative content to it, and you read it, And I mean, I don't know about the original narrative in Livy, but it's a version of what you would read and learn when you're learning about classical antiquity. So that I think you do have to think about painting as being a different type of genre. And that remains a big argument in the late 18th century, because there are always these people who want it to be about history. And there were these categories, and history painting was regarded as the best form of painting, and then portraiture is relatively low as a genre. But on the other hand, most people actually wanted to pay the money for portraiture, so that artists get locked into portraiture and only some of them break out of it.
I was struck by the description of some of the members of the Royal Academy who traveled extensively to China, to Italy. Nowadays, we might hear that and think, well, okay, that's an airplane ride away. I mean, these were considerable journeys, undertakings. I mean, I would think that artists could have lost their lives in these travels.
I do think it's sort of amazing how cosmopolitan they were. You do get the sense that in the way the Society of Artists fragments, it's the ones who were well-travelled, surrounded by antiquity. So, but what you say is absolutely correct. The ability to travel, and it wasn't straightforward. You know, there was a well-travelled route, but it took weeks. you know, some of it was by boat and some of it was by horse. Poor old Reynolds had got a thing on his lip because he'd fallen off a horse in Menorca when he was going out to Italy. So it wasn't totally straightforward.
Are there major artists, either in the 18th century or even up until today, who eschewed the idea of the Royal Academy, would say, I don't want to be a member of that group? Or was it something that every artist aspired to, that it became a imprimatur of quality, of craftsmanship?
There are certainly people at the time who either stood aside from it or were slightly ambivalent about it, or weren't invited. Gainsborough was elected, but he was at that stage in Bath, and you get the feeling he never really thought that much of the Academy. And he was required by council to stand down because there was a dispute, and then after 4 years, because he was a very good artist, he comes back in. That pattern of slight ambiguity towards the Royal Academy as an artist's establishment is not only a 20th century phenomenon. I think it goes back to the 18th century. And then I like the fact, and I find it really interesting, that Robert Adam, the architect, who of all the people at the time you would expect to have been an academician, he'd been trained in Rome, he was a rising star in London, he did classical design, he was much admired by the king. And in February, he sends a copy of his Ruins of Spoletro, this great folio book, with an ingratiating note saying how pleased he is to hear of the establishment of the Royal Academy. And you sort of feel there's an audible PS, and I look forward to the call. And then it never happens, because Chambers was his rival. And presumably every time somebody, one of the painters said, how about Robert Adam, William Chambers somehow managed to make it clear that Robert Adam wasn't going to become an academician. So that, again, that's a very standard pattern in the 19th century. There are people you would expect to have been academicians but never quite make it. Or like, I'm just doing some work on Watts, and he's surprised, everybody's surprised that he's made an academician late, and then he doesn't really like it when he does become one, and Burne-Jones leaves it. And in the 20th century, that's a much more familiar story. That by the 20th century, I think people are a bit suspicious of the idea of an academy, and they feel it's rather reactionary. But now, I think and hope, I mean, there are people now, Damien Hirst was elected, and I was in the room when somebody rang him up. I think Tracy Emin rang him up, and everybody waited, and he said, I couldn't. And I've often wondered what was behind that, I couldn't.
When you say you wonder what was behind it?
Well, I assume, you know, it was an instinct, a gut instinct. He didn't want, probably, to be incorporated by what he saw as an artist's establishment, that still it would have had some form of public incorporation, which he would be wary of and not want. But having said that, Tracy Emin herself is quite open about the fact that actually, however well-esteemed or well-known you are, there's something very nice about to be recognised by your fellow artists, and also artists of an older generation. I think she's not in any need of it professionally, but she still likes it.
Acceptance by your peers, and particularly people who, whether you knew them or not, mentored in a way through the collective work of artists, that everyone out in the world, I mean, as Rauschenberg said, all art is collaborative in a way, that all these members of the Academy, all the senior artists, whether they were Academy or not, have inspired younger artists in one way or another, either to do work branching off of that or to rebel against it.
I see it. I mean, Tracy Emin is a good example, because there were two people in particular that she was taught by at the Royal College of Art, Paul Huxley and Adrian Berg. And Adrian Berg is not especially well-known as an artist. He died recently, but he was a lovely person. What you get a sense of is that there's the public aspect of art exhibitions, curators, writers, critics, and artists have to engage with them. But in the end, they feel more comfortable with the judgment and assessment of fellow artists. They feel artists are the people who are the true judges of people's abilities, and that the Academy represents the judgment of their peer group. You can feel, I mean, I sense, because I witness it, is that at different stages of people's lives, they like the community. And I find it interesting, and I wouldn't have been aware of it before I was at the Academy. The art was extremely cruel, because you can be very, very successful, and then taste changes, and then suddenly you don't have public esteem. And at that point, I think professional esteem becomes very valuable, because essentially, I find it interesting that if you think of the literary world, once you've been a successful writer, you know, Salman Rushdie may not sell so many copies of his latest novel, but everybody knows he's a part of the pantheon. He's came to public awareness in the 1980s, and because of the books he's written, he will remain a significant writer, and everybody knows that. But I think with painting, particularly, you can be very, very successful, and then taste changes, people don't buy your work, and suddenly you find yourself much less in the public eye. And that's tough. And at that point, I think the Academy provides a sort of sense of longevity of attitude and taste and admiration. And that consoles people.
Keeps the self-esteem up.
Keeps the self-esteem up. Yeah. And you can, I mean, one can be cynical about it, but also uncynical. It's a community.
Indeed, a community of artists. In Charles Summers Smith's book called The Company of Artists, The Origins of the Royal Academy of Arts in London, published by Bloomsbury, it's a book that describes how it is that recalcitrant, taciturn, outspoken, cranky personalities can create an organization that provides a meeting place, a home for their art, for discussion and debate, for people to come and to leave, to get new ideas. It's been a thrill to come to know the Royal Academy, been able to take a life drawing class, sitting in the room that John Ruskin used to use. You're listening to West Coast Live, today coming to you from London, today exploring the layers of history that connect with our present time. This is Edge Thompson. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Try out others from West Coast Live right here, and we look forward to having you in one of our audiences one day. For more information, wcl.org.